So, before we even jump into the material today, I just want to say real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Right.
Yeah, they've got this full series 9 to 9 course. It has adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing, which is huge.
It really is.
Yeah, so you definitely want to check that out at certfuel.com. Okay, so with that out of the way, I want you to imagine you are staring at a Bloomberg terminal.
Okay.
The market is just absolutely screaming. Everything's flashing red and green. You hit buy on this massive order, like 10,000 shares. And in the, 3 milliseconds it takes for that fiber optic signal to reach some server in New Jersey, the price jumps.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have to wonder, did you just get uniquely unlucky? Or did the broker who was handling your order just, commit a felony?
Right, what happens?
Exactly. So today we are diving into the exact rule book that separates a fair, transparent market from basically a rigged casino.
Yeah, and it's the perfect sponsor for this, by the way, because today we are tackling function one of the Series 99 exam material.
Yes, we are.
And for the operations professionals out there listening, this is really the architecture of your entire career.
Literally.
Yeah, we're looking at trade reporting, best execution, corrections, prohibited activities. We are tracing the full life cycle of a trade.
So I'm just going to break the fourth wall right out of the gate here and speak directly to you, the listener.
Go for it.
If you are multitasking right now, or if you're like zoning out on a treadmill, snap back to attention.
Yeah, pay attention to this part.
Seriously, because this single function we are covering today, it has 35 scored items.
That's a lot.
It is 70% of the entire Series 99 exam.
Cool.
70%. So if you master the mechanics that we talk about today, you are practically holding your passing score in your hand.
Absolutely.
And we are going to make this stick for your ADHD brain because we're going to use some very vivid scenarios today. So just lock in.
I love it. So to kind of map out the narrative arc here, we are going to follow a trade from its inception all the way to execution and reporting.
Right.
We'll start from that exact moment. A broker takes the order and has to decide, what capacity they're acting in.
Which is super important.
Very. And then we move to how they broadcast that action to the market through quotations and reporting. Next, we look at what I like to call the quarantine
The
zone.
quarantine zone, yeah.
Basically, what happens when they inevitably make a mistake and have to correct the ledger. And then finally, we venture into the dark side of trading.
The fun stuff.
Right, the highly illegal, heavily testable fact patterns of market manipulation.
Yes. So to keep all these abstract financial regulations grounded, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters today.
Let's do it.
And these aren't just cartoon characters, these are the archetypes of the industry. So first, we have Broker Bob.
Broker Bob.
Picture this stressed out mid-level trader at a high volume broker-dealer desk. He's drinking, I don't know, his fourth cold brew of the day.
Sweating a little bit.
Oh, definitely sweating. He's trying to juggle 50 routing systems without catching a FINRA violation.
We all know a Bob.
We do. Then we have client Kathy. So Kathy is a retail investor. She's trading from her phone, probably on her lunch break, and she's just trying to get a fair execution price to build up her retirement account for her family.
Right, your standard retail client.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And finally, we have Block Trade Brenda.
Oh, Brenda.
Block Trade Brenda is an icy, heavy-hitting institutional trader. She works at a massive pension fund, and she moves millions of dollars of volume at a single time, and she expects flawless execution.
She does not mess around.
No, she does not.
Having Bob, Kathy, and Brenda as our sort of avatars for this is going to really help visualize the actual plumbing of these rules, because none of this happens in a vacuum.
Right.
Every single rule we're going to talk about exists because somebody, at some point in market history, tried to exploit a loophole.
Somebody got greedy.
Always. So let's start right at the beginning. Part one, the core roles. So before a trade can even hit the tape, we have to know exactly who Broker Bob is pretending to be today.
Which introduces the concept of trading capacity.
Exactly. Trading capacity identifies the legal and the structural role that the broker-dealer takes in a given transaction.
Okay.
So every single time Bob touches an order, his firm is acting in one of two distinct capacities. He's either an agent or he's a principal.
Agent or principal.
Right. And the regulatory expectations, the risk profile, and frankly, the way Bob gets paid, they all change completely based on which hat he's wearing.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy because that helps me. Tell me where this breaks down, all right?
Sure.
So, agent versus principal. An agent is like an Uber driver. They don't own the car you are buying. They're just getting your order from point A to point B. They act on behalf of the customer and they charge a flat fee, like a commission, for the ride. But a principal is like a car dealership. They are selling you a car directly out of their own lot, from their own inventory. They take on the risk of owning that inventory, and they make their money by marking the price up when they sell it to you, or marking it down when they buy it from you. Does that track?
That analogy holds up perfectly, yeah. But let's look at the mechanical risk behind it, because you have to ask, why does a firm choose one over the other?
What's the incentive?
Well, what's fascinating here is when Broker Bob acts as an agent, so your Uber driver, he takes zero balance sheet risk,
Zero.
right? Client Kathy says, hey, buy me 100 shares of Apple. So Bob goes out in the open market, he finds a seller, matches them up, and takes his commission. If the stock tanks 5 minutes later, Bob doesn't care. He was just the conduit.
He's still got his Uber fare,
Exactly.
but if he acts as a principal.
If he acts as a principal, Bob is a direct party to the transaction. His firm actually owns those shares of Apple. So when Kathy says, buy me 100 shares, Bob looks at his firm's internal inventory and says, okay, I will sell these to you from our vault.
But
The firm is taking on massive market risk by holding that inventory overnight, right? Which is why regulators allow them to charge a markup instead of just a standard commission. They're basically being compensated for the risk of holding the bag if the market turns against them.
Which, if you think about it, that introduces a major conflict of interest,
Oh,
right?
absolutely,
Because
yeah.
if Bob is selling from his own inventory, he naturally wants to sell it to Kathy for the highest price possible,
Right.
but Kathy wants the lowest price possible.
Yeah, they are directly at odds. And that inherent conflict of interest is exactly why the rules around disclosure are so incredibly strict.
Oh, I see.
When a customer gets their trade confirmation, it must explicitly state the capacity in which the broker-dealer acted. Kathy needs to know, was Bob her neutral messenger, or was Bob the guy sitting across the negotiating table from her trying to make a profit?
That makes total sense. And this leads us directly into what is probably the most critical obligation Bob has to Kathy, regardless of whether he's an agent or a principal. And this is a massive concept for the Series 99. We're talking about best execution.
Best execution. Yes. This is really the foundational bedrock of customer trust in the markets. The rule requires a member firm to use reasonable diligence to ascertain the best market for the subject security and to buy or sell in such a market so that the resultant price to the customer is as favorable as possible under prevailing market conditions.
Okay, listeners, this is where the exam tries to get you. So listen up.
Big time.
I know a lot of veteran traders who actually get this wrong and they end up facing FINRA inquiries because they completely misunderstand this
Yeah,
standard.
they do.
Best execution is a diligence standard. It is not a price guarantee.
That is such a vital distinction. The rule does not mandate that the broker magically secure the absolute lowest mathematical price across every single dark pool and exchange in existence.
Right, because that's impossible.
It's technologically impossible. The standard is reasonable diligence. Regulators want to look at the process Bob used to route the order, not just the final number on the receipt.
Okay, let's put Broker Bob to the test with a real-world scenario.
All right, poor Bob.
I know, he's stressed. So it's Tuesday morning. The Federal Reserve just unexpectedly announced this massive interest rate hike, and the market is in absolute free fall.
Total panic.
Incredibly volatile. And client Kathy submits a market order from her app.
Right.
She says, buy me 500 shares of this tech stock right now.
Okay.
Bob's desk receives the order. He uses his firm's smart order router. He checks multiple quoting systems. He evaluates the liquidity. He executes the trade. But because the market is tanking so fast, Kathy ends up with a pretty mediocre price compared to what she saw on her screen just like 10 seconds earlier.
Oh, yeah, we see this exact scenario during every major market shock. I mean, from the 2010 flash crash to CPI data release days, the customer looks at the execution price, they look at the ticker on CNBC, and they just scream, I got ripped off.
So, listener, I want you to think about this for a beat. Imagine you're sitting in the testing center. This is a question on your exam. Did Broker Bob violate the rule of best execution?
Think about it. Watch your answer. Okay, tell them.
The answer is no, he did not. A worse price is not an automatic violation.
Right.
You have to look at the phrase under prevailing market conditions. In your scenario, the market was in free fall. Liquidity was basically evaporating. Bob used reasonable diligence to find the best available market in that specific chaotic moment.
Yeah.
The exam loves to throw a terrible price at you in a fact pattern, just to trick you into choosing, yes, this is a violation. Do not fall for it. The regulators are auditing Bob's routing logic, his review of execution quality, and his diligence. They are not punishing him for the Fed's actions.
Exactly. Now, to determine if Bob actually used diligence, regulators look at a few specific factors, right?
Yeah.
Like, what are the main things FedNR is looking for if they audit Bob's desk for best X?
So they look at a few things. First, the character of the market for that specific security.
Okay.
You know, is it a highly liquid stock like Microsoft, or is it a thinly traded penny stock where quotes are super scarce?
Right, totally different games. Completely.
Yeah.
They also look at the size and type of the transaction. A 10-share order routes very differently than a 10,000-share block order.
For sure.
And importantly, they look at the number of markets Bob checked and the accessibility of the quotation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if Bob routed Kathy's order to some obscure affiliate exchange that his firm happens to own, just so he could collect a rebate.
Oh, wow.
While completely ignoring a much better price sitting right there on the NASDAQ,
yeah.
That is a massive best execution failure.
Yeah, that's just shady. So that makes perfect sense. The process is what protects the customer.
Right.
Okay, so Broker Bob survives his first test. He executed Kathy's order with proper diligence. But he can't just keep that execution a secret on his desk.
Nope.
In the financial markets, a trade didn't happen unless the entire world knows it happened.
Exactly.
Which forces us to look at the plumbing of market transparency. Let's move to part two. Quotations and trade reporting. I call this the megaphone.
The megaphone. I like that. Because trade reporting is what converts an isolated private transaction into public information that the market, the algorithms, and the regulators can actually rely on to determine pricing.
Right.
But before we even get to the transaction report itself, we have to talk about how the market communicates before a trade even happens.
Mm.
We have to talk about quotations.
And here's where I want to push back on the terminology a bit.
Okay.
Because when I think of a quote, I picture a flashing green or red number on a computer screen.
Sure.
Like a bid to buy at $10, an offer to sell at $10.05. But the sources for this exam state that a quotation is way more than just a displayed price. How can a quote be something other than a price?
It seems super counterintuitive, I know, but a quotation under FINRA rules actually includes any formula designed to induce a person to make or submit a bid or offer.
A formula, like a mathematical equation.
Well, think of it more as a formalized public request for negotiation. So if Broker Bob has this illiquid corporate bond that he really wants to sell, there might not be a flashing green price on a screen because, well, no one trades it.
Right. It's just sitting there.
Exactly. So Bob posts an OW, which stands for an offer wanted, or BWA, bid wanted, on a quotation medium. He's essentially holding up a digital sign saying, hey, I have this bond. Please throw some numbers at me.
Oh, I see.
And under the regulatory framework, that beacon, that request to induce a bid, officially counts as a quotation.
That is fascinating. So the regulators are casting a very wide net here. They are saying, if you are trying to drum up interest in a public forum, you are quoting.
Yes.
And because he is quoting, he is subject to strict rules about the firmness of that quote, right?
Oh, absolutely. Firmness is the glue that holds the secondary market together. The core rule here is absolute. A stated price offer must be honored under its stated conditions, period. If Broker Bob broadcasts to the market, I will buy 500 shares at $50, and another trader hits that quote, Bob has to buy those shares at $50.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot back away from a firm quote just because the market moved against you in the last half second.
Oh man, you can't just be like, never mind.
No, backing away is a severe violation.
Right, but we are humans, right? We're dealing with physical limitations. Let's use an analogy for a crucial exception to this rule.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine Bob is a chef in a high-end restaurant kitchen.
Right.
He has one steak left, and he has it listed on the menu for $50. Table A orders the steak. So Bud is actively in the middle of plating that steak for Table A when the waiter from Table B runs into the kitchen and says, hey, I also want a steak for $50.
Right.
Bob can't fulfill it. He is allowed to say, look, I am revising my menu size to zero because I am literally in the middle of a transaction for that exact inventory.
That is the perfect way to understand the quotation size exception.
Oh, no.
Because the SEC and FINRA, they recognize that human traders and even sequential routing systems can really only process one event at a time.
Yeah.
So if Bob is already affecting a transaction in the quoted security, When a new order arrives, he is allowed to communicate a revised quotation size immediately after that in-progress transaction is completed.
So Bob tells the incoming order, "Hey, I was literally on the phone executing my quoted size when your order hit my terminal, so I'm revising my size down to zero."
Correct. And Bob is not obligated to trade beyond that newly revised size, provided he communicates it immediately.
Got it.
And this exception exists to protect broker-dealers from basically infinite liability.
What do you mean?
Well, without it, think about high-frequency trading algorithms. They could bombard a single firm, quote, with 1,000 orders in a millisecond.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Forcing the firm to buy a million shares they never intended to buy, which would bankrupt the broker-dealer instantly.
The mechanics of that exception really highlight just how fast the market moves.
It's terrifyingly fast.
It really is. Now, let's talk about the standard of truth for these quotes and reports. Because regulators require them to be real, this brings up the bona fide standard.
Right. And the word bona fide, it just means genuine or real. But there is a very subtle, highly testable difference in the regulatory standard for a transaction report versus a published quotation.
Okay, listener, this is another exam trap. Listen closely. The reporting system itself does not magically make a trade real.
No, it doesn't.
Just because Broker Bob types some numbers into a Fenera terminal and hits enter does not mean the trade was bona fide. Let's compare the two standards directly, side by side.
Let's start with a transaction report. This is after the trade has theoretically happened.
Okay.
For a transaction report, the rule states that Bob must actually believe the reported transaction was a bona fide purchase or sale.
He has to believe it.
Yes. If he knows or even has reason to believe that the trade is entirely fictitious, like maybe two traders at his firm are just swapping shares back and forth at the exact same price just to create the illusion of volume.
Oh, like wash trading?
Exactly. Publishing that report is a massive violation.
Okay, so for a transaction report, Bob must explicitly believe it is real. What about for publishing a quotation, which happens, you know, before a trade?
For a published quotation, Bob needs reasonable cause to believe the quotation is bona fide, is not fictitious, and crucially, this is the extra phrase you need to know, has no fraudulent, deceptive, or manipulative purpose.
Wait, so report equals believes it's bona fide.
Right.
Quote equals reasonable cause to believe it's bona fide with no manipulative purpose. Why the extra language about manipulation specifically for a quote?
Because you can manipulate a market without ever actually trading a single share.
Really?
Yeah, it's called spoofing. High-frequency traders have been caught flooding the market with massive fake quotes to buy a stock, which creates this false sense of immense demand.
Oh, so everyone thinks it's hot.
Right. The algorithms see this demand and drive the price up. The spoofer then sells their existing shares at the artificially inflated price and immediately cancels all their fake buy quotes.
Wow.
They never meant to buy anything. The quote itself was the weapon. That is why the regulatory standard for a quotation explicitly forbids manipulative purpose.
That is wild. The quote itself is a psychological weapon against the market.
It really is.
Okay, so Broker Bob quoted his trade fairly, he executed Kathy's order with diligence, and he reported it believing it was bona fide.
Good job, Bob.
But Bob is only human. It's 3.00 p.m., his cold brew is wearing off, and he messes up.
Of course he does.
He records the wrong account number on a trade, or maybe he executes 500 shares instead of 50. How does the firm fix a broken trade without destroying the integrity of the market ledger?
Right.
Welcome to part three, the quarantine zone.
I really love that name. Because every firm has to have a mechanism for dealing with mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about error accounts.
Right. When I read the source material on error accounts, I immediately pictured a quarantine zone, like a biohazard tent with yellow tape around it.
Yep.
An error account is a separate firm account used strictly to record and control a trading error, while the compliance team figures out what on earth Bob just did.
The quarantine analogy is spot on. The entire purpose of the error account is to separate the mistake from ordinary, healthy transaction activity.
Keep it away from the good stuff.
Exactly. And a trading error can arise from a multitude of sins. Mm-hmm. You know, Bob mishandled the order, the routing system glitched, or someone just fat-fingered a reporting entry.
Here is an exam trap I want to flag for our listeners.
Go ahead.
The exam will try to trick you into thinking the error account functions like an airplane's black box, right? That it diagnoses the problem, it does not.
No. Take that a step further. If a regulator audits the error account, they just see a list of broken trades.
That's it.
That's it. The error account does not say Bob transposed two digits because he was distracted by an email. Its sole regulatory purpose is separate recording and control. It basically proves to Finera that the firm recognized a problem, pulled it out of the customer's account so the customer isn't harmed, and parked it in a firm-owned account until it can be resolved.
It's basically a waiting room for mistakes.
Yep.
But eventually, those mistakes have to be corrected on the public tape. Which brings us to trader corrections. Now, I want you to picture Bob running around the office trying to fix a time-space continuum paradox because he forgot to report a trade on time yesterday.
Classic Bob.
Right. He has two main tools for this. He has an AOF report and a past settlement date correction.
And let me tell you, these two labels sound incredibly similar, and candidates constantly mix them up. But they address entirely different mechanisms in the clearing process.
Let's start with the AOF report. An AOF report is submitted after the execution date. But the golden rule here is that it must include the original execution date.
Right.
I like to think of the AOF report as a time machine pointing backward.
I like that.
It is Bob telling the tape, hey, I'm reporting this to you today on Wednesday, but I need you to record it as of Tuesday when the trade actually happened.
And the reason that time machine is so vital goes back to the clearinghouses.
Okay.
Specifically, the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, the DTCC. They calculate margin requirements and risk based on the exact execution date.
Oh, so the math has to be perfect.
Yes. If Bob submits the trade a day late and just uses today's date, he throws off the entire risk calculation for the firm. The AOF report preserves the original execution date to keep the math accurate.
So an AOF report points backward to the execution date. Now contrast that with a past settlement date correction.
The defining mechanic here is right in the name. It is not just about the execution date being wrong. It means the actual physical window for the trade to settle, for the cash and the shares to officially swap hands, has already come and gone.
It's closed.
Exactly.
So, listener, I want you to visualize this. If you are looking at a question on the Series 99, and the fact pattern asks about a trade corrected after the settlement cycle has come and gone, what is the key trigger you are looking for in the answer set?
Give them a second.
Got it.
You are looking for the settlement status. That is the trigger.
Yep.
An AOF report concerns the report date acting against the execution date. A past settlement date correction concerns the settlement window having passed. They test two entirely different timeline references.
Boom. If you can separate the execution date from the settlement date, you win those points on the exam.
You really will.
Now let's talk about how you actually input these corrections into the FINRA or NYSE systems. Because, you know, you can't just sit backspace.
No, you can't. And this is a fundamental concept of database architecture for regulators. The FINRA trade reporting facilities operate essentially like an immutable ledger.
Like blockchain, kinda?
Sort of, yeah. Once a trade is printed to the tape, it cannot simply be deleted or edited over. Regulators need to see the complete audit trail of the mistake.
So if Bob realizes he needs to correct a FENYA or NYSE report after its initial report date, he has to perform what I call a two-step dance.
It is a dance. Step one, the firm must submit a reversal of the original erroneous trade. This publicly nullifies the bad data.
Okay.
Step two, the firm must submit a brand new, correctly formatted AOF trade report to replace it.
Okay, I want to repeat that to really lock it into your memory, listener. If you are correcting an older report, what is step one?
Say it out loud.
Reverse of the trade.
Right.
And what is step two?
Submit a new AOF report.
Reverse. New AOF. Yeah. Reverse. New AOF.
Exactly.
The immutable ledger demands that you show your work. You have to show the mistake being undone and show the correct version being applied.
It is the only way FINRA can track whether a firm is making honest mistakes or intentionally manipulating the tape and trying to cover their tracks later.
Which is the perfect transition. We have been pretty easy on Broker Bob so far, right?
We have.
Making an honest mistake and submitting an AOF report is a compliance headache, but it happens. But what if Bob is not making a mistake? What if Bob decides to be greedy? Let's move to part four, the don't do this list. These are the prohibited activities.
Yeah, when a broker-dealer crosses this line, they face massive fines, suspensions, and potentially criminal charges. These rules are the ultimate firewall protecting customers from predatory practices.
So let's start with a direct comparison between two market manipulation tactics that honestly sound identical to a layperson, but have vastly different fact patterns on the exam. I am talking about front running versus trading ahead.
Confusing these two is a classic exam pitfall. Let's bring our characters back to visualize the mechanics.
Yes. Enter block trade Brenda.
The legend.
She is our heavy-hitting institutional trader. Brenda works at a pension fund, and she is about to move 10,000 shares of a mid-cap stock. Now, listener, 10,000 shares is the magic regulatory threshold for a block trade right. that number down. It is highly testable.
Very testable.
So Brenda calls broker Bob's desk to handle this massive order.
Okay, now Bob is sitting at his desk. He knows that when a 10,000 share buy order hits the open market, it is going to consume all the available supply.
Oh yeah, it's going to eat it all up.
The stock price is guaranteed to shoot upward. Bob now possesses material non-public market information.
So Bob gets greedy. While Brenda's order is sitting on his desk, Bob logs into his firm's proprietary account, or even his own personal account, and buys 500 shares of that exact stock before he executes Brenda's trade.
Yeah.
He is buying at the lower price. Then he executes Brenda's 10,000 shares. The market spikes, and Bob immediately sells his 500 shares for a guaranteed risk-free profit.
This specific crime is front-running. You are running in front of a massive market-moving block order. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, if we look at the mechanics of how a block trade is executed, it raises a crucial question.
What's that?
When is Bob legally allowed to trade for himself again? When does that information actually become public?
Well, let's say Brenda's massive order is so big that Bob has to route it to different dark pools and exchanges. It takes three separate chunks to fill.
Okay.
The first two chunks are completed and reported on the public tape. Can Bob trade for his own account at that point?
Absolutely not. And I've seen veteran institutional traders get fired over this exact misunderstanding.
Really?
Yes. Reporting a partial fill of a block does not make the information public. The information is considered material and non-public until the entire block transaction is completed and publicly reported to the tape.
Wow.
If Bob trades even 1 second before that final chunk is printed, he is guilty of front running.
Okay, so a block trade of 10,000 shares involving material non-public info equals front-running. Now, let's contrast that with trading ahead. Enter client Kathy.
Okay, Kathy is a retail customer. She places a standard limit order to buy 100 shares of a stock at $45.
Mm-hmm.
Broker Bob accepts her order and is holding it on his desk.
Bob sees a seller in the market offering the stock at $44.90. Instead of routing Kathy's order to capture that great price, Bob buys those shares for his own firm's proprietary account at $44.90.
Terrible.
He leaves Kathy hanging. He got the good price for himself and ignored a customer order he was actively holding that could have been satisfied by that exact price.
This is trading ahead of a customer order. The firm placed its own financial interests ahead of a customer order it accepted and was actively holding.
Bob must immediately execute Kathy's order at that same price or better to satisfy the rule.
So here is your memory trick for the exam. If the FAT pattern mentions 10,000 shares, institutional orders, or imminent market-moving information,
mm-hmm.
you were looking at front-running.
Right.
If the FAT pattern mentions a broker holding a standard retail customer order and trading for its own account at a price that would satisfy the customer,
yeah.
you are looking at trading ahead.
Exactly.
Block FAT pattern equals front-running. Customer FAT pattern equals trading ahead. That is a perfect diagnostic tool. Now, let's talk about how Bob treats Kathy over a longer time horizon. Let's talk about excessive trading, which is commonly known as churning.
Churning, right. Churning is when a broker trades a customer's account excessively just to generate commissions for themselves. But the exam trap here focuses on the definition of excessive.
It does.
The exam might give you a scenario where Bob recommends one incredibly risky, highly active options trade for Kathy. Just one. Is that single trade considered churning?
No. One isolated trade, no matter how aggressive, does not establish churning. The core regulatory concept of churning is that it relies on a series of recommended transactions.
A series.
You have to view the account activity in its entirety. Is the turnover rate suitable for a retail investor who's just saving for college? If Bob is turning over Kathy's entire portfolio value 3 times a month, that series of transactions constitutes churning.
Which leads us directly into one of the most sweeping regulatory changes of the last decade. Regulation Best Interest, or REGBI?
Yes. To understand REGBI, you really have to look at the history.
Okay.
For decades, brokers operated under the suitability standard. If Bob sold Kathy a mutual fund that fit her general risk profile, it was considered suitable, even if Bob chose that specific fund just because it paid him a massive kickback.
Oh, wow. So it was suitable, but not necessarily the best option.
Right. Regulators realized this wasn't protecting retail investors enough. Thus, REGBI was born in 2020.
So REGBI applies specifically when a broker-dealer recommends a securities transaction or an investment strategy to a retail customer.
Correct.
And the definition of a retail customer is a natural person using the recommendation primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. So Block Trade Brenda acting for a pension fund, does not get Reg BI protection.
Oh.
But client Kathy, saving for her kids' college, absolutely does.
Exactly. And the fundamental standard of Reg BI is powerful. Bob cannot put his own financial interest ahead of Kathy's. It elevates the standard closer to a fiduciary duty. Reg BI is built on four mandatory pillars: disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance.
Disclosure, care, conflict, compliance. Think about the conflict pillar for a second. If there are two identical S&P 500 index funds, right? But Fund A pays Bob a 2% commission and Fund B pays him nothing.
Right.
Under the old rules, Bob could sell Fund A. Under Reg BI, if Bob recommends Fund A strictly to line his own pockets when a cheaper identical alternative exists, he just violated the rule.
He placed his wallet ahead of the customer's best interest.
Yeah.
It is a strict liability scenario.
Okay, here is where things get really interesting and, frankly, a bit deceptive.
Uh-oh.
I was reading through the sources on pricing rules, and I found something called the 5% markup policy.
Oh, yes.
So let's go back to Bob acting as a principal, the car dealership model. He is selling bonds from his own inventory to Kathy. He marks up the price to make a profit. If Bob marks up that bond by 4.9%, he is totally safe, right? Because he stayed under the 5% threshold.
Absolutely not.
Really?
This is perhaps the biggest illusion and the most common trap on the exam. The 5% policy is a ghost. It is guidance. It is not a safe harbor, and it is certainly not a fixed regulatory ceiling.
Wait, if it's not a rule, where did it even come from? Why is it 5%?
Well, it originated all the way back in 1943 from the NASD, which was FINRA's predecessor.
Okay.
Regulators surveyed the industry and found that the vast majority of markets at the time were 5% or less. So they issued a guideline saying, generally, markups should not exceed 5%. But over the decades, markets became wildly more efficient and liquid.
So if 4.9% isn't an automatic safe harbor, what actually makes a markup illegal?
Price fairness is based on all relevant circumstances. FINRA looks at the type of security, its availability, its price, and the total dollar amount of the transaction.
Okay.
So if Bob charges a 3% markup on a massive, highly liquid treasury bond trade, where the industry standard markup might be a fraction of a percent, that 3% could be deemed grossly unfair and excessive, leading to severe sanctions.
So a 3% markup can be illegal, while a 6% markup on a rare, incredibly illiquid penny stock that took Bob 3 weeks to track down, that might actually be justified.
Precisely. The exam will definitely throw a 4.9% markup scenario at you and ask if it is a guaranteed safe harbor. It is not.
Yeah.
Never assume a number protects you from the requirement to deal fairly.
That is wild. It's a ghost rule. Okay, speaking of greedy broker behavior, let's talk about breakpoint sales.
Oh boy.
When I first read about this, it seemed absurd that a broker would actively do this.
It happens way more often than you think. A prohibited breakpoint sale involves investment company shares, specifically mutual funds with front-end loads.
Right.
Mutual funds incentivize large investments by offering volume discounts on the sales charge. The dollar threshold where the discount triggers is called a breakpoint.
So let's look at the mechanics of this. Let's say a mutual fund charges a 5% sales fee for investments under $50,000. But if you invest $50,000 or more, the fee drops to 4%.
Okay.
That $50,000 mark is the breakpoint. Client Kathy calls Bob and says, "Hey, Bob, I have exactly $50,000 to invest in this fund." Bob knows that if she hits that breakpoint, her fee drops, which means Bob's commission drops.
Yep.
So Bob uses his silver tongue and says, "Hey, Kathy, markets are choppy. Let's just invest $49,000 right now. Keep that $1,000 in cash for a rainy day."
And right there, Bob just committed a prohibited breakpoint sale. He intentionally kept the customer just below the breakpoint specifically so he could share in the higher sales charge. He actively engineered a scenario to avoid the available discount for his client.
It is so dirty. His sole motivation was padding his own commission. Now, the sources note that regulators do look at facts and circumstances.
I do.
Like if Bob was placing Kathy into a legitimate multi-fund asset allocation strategy designed for diversification, and he properly disclosed in writing that spreading her money out would cause her to miss a breakpoint, that might be defensible. But doing it just to keep the fee high, highly illegal.
Exactly. Intent matters. And we can round out our don't do this list with a few more prohibited payments that corrupt the market's integrity.
Hit me. Let's hear them.
First, improper sharing in profits and losses. You cannot share in a customer's profits, and you cannot guarantee them against losses.
No guarantee.
The prohibition covers both sides of the ledger. Broker Bob cannot say, "Hey, Kathy, I'll waive my commission today, but I want 10% of whatever upside this stock makes over the next month."
Which prevents brokers from taking insane asymmetrical risks with a client's money just to chase a performance payout, right?
Exactly.
What about paying for hype, like pumping up a stock?
also strictly prohibited. Payments involving publications. A broker-dealer cannot give payments or anything of value to influence or reward a person's action concerning the publication of material intended to affect a security's market price.
So no bribing.
Right. You cannot bribe a financial newsletter writer or a prominent blogger to pump up a stock you're trying to sell.
And what about the issuer of the stock itself?
Yeah.
Let's say a newly public tech company comes to Broker Bob's desk and says, hey, our stock is a little illiquid. We will pay you $10,000 a month to make a market in our stock. Publish quotes, provide liquidity, keep the bid-ask spread tight.
Prohibited. Payments for market making cannot be accepted from an issuer, an affiliate, or a promoter.
Wow, not even from the company itself.
Nope. And think about why this rule exists.
Yeah.
It goes back to our earlier discussion on the bona fide standard for quotations.
Oh, great.
If Bob is publishing a firm quote to buy a stock, the market relies on that quote as a true reflection of supply and demand. If Bob is only quoting it because the issuer slipped him an envelope of cash to create the illusion of liquidity, the entire tape is corrupted.
It all circles back to the core theme of the Series 99. Commercial honor and just and equitable principles of trade. The financial markets only function if the data on the tape is real and if the human actors are dealing fairly.
That is the philosophical underpinning of every rule in Function 1.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of technical ground today. Broker Bob has been an agent, a principal, a front runner, and a terrible record keeper.
He's had a long day.
He really has. So to lock this in before you sit for your exam, let's do a rapid fire recap.
Let's do it.
A lightning round of the top testable takeaways. Listener, I want you to test your recall here. I will read the concept and you try to answer before the expert does. Ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. Best execution.
It is a reasonable diligence standard, not a price guarantee. Evaluated under prevailing market conditions.
Trading capacity. Agent versus principal.
Agent is the messenger taking zero balance sheet risk for a commission. Principal is the dealer trading from their own firm's inventory for a markup or markdown.
The quotation size exception.
You can revise a firm quote size immediately, but only if you just completed an in-progress transaction for that security.
Error accounts.
They are quarantine zones for separate recording and control. They do not diagnose or explain the source of the error.
Correcting a FINRA or NYSE report after the report date.
The two-step dance for the immutable ledger. Reverse the original trade, then submit a new as-off report.
Institutional block trades over 10,000 shares versus standard retail customer orders.
Trading ahead of a block trade is front-running, and the block is not public until the entire order is reported. Trading ahead of a retail order is trading ahead.
The 5% markup policy.
It is a ghost. It is historical guidance, not a safe harbor or a fixed ceiling. Fairness is based on all relevant circumstances.
Brilliant. Listeners, if you were able to anticipate those answers, you are in incredible shape for Function 1.
You really are.
Yeah.
But before we wrap this deep dive, I want to leave everyone with a final provocative thought to mull over, especially as the industry evolves.
Ooh, let's hear it.
We spent the last chunk of time talking about how humans, like our stressed-out broker Bob, handle orders, check prevailing conditions, and deal with errors. But as algorithms and artificial intelligence increasingly take over the actual routing and execution of these trades in fractions of a microsecond,
yeah,
who exactly is legally responsible for best execution when a black box machine decides the route? If an AI decides that a worse price on a dark pool was optimally diligent based on 1,000 parameters that human regulators cannot even decipher, how do you audit that?
Man, that's a good question.
It is something to think about as the market continues to outpace the traditional rule book.
That is an incredible point, because the rules of fairness stay the same, but the players executing them are becoming purely digital. Like, who goes to jail when the algorithm front runs a block trade? Wild.
Exactly.
All right, that is our time. You are now fully armed and ready to conquer Function 1 of the Series 99. Keep studying, trust your diligence, and we will catch you on the next deep dive. Keep diving.